evidenced by the fact that dozens of prominent lawyers, including former New York judges and even prosecutors, went public with grievances they filed against Rudy Giuliani over his role in Donald Trump's efforts to subvert the 2020 presidential election and encourage the 6th of January riot at the Capitol. To date, none of these lawyers have faced public sanctions for speaking to the press. In theory, the secrecy law exists to protect lawyers from being smeared by frivolous complaints. But that rationale makes no sense when applied to prosecutors, who are public officials doing the state's work. In the Queen's cases, their misconduct is already a matter of public record. Even if it weren't, there is no principled reason to prevent the public airing of complaints, not to mention public hearings against officials who have the power to send people to prison. Certainly, the defendants they face off against in courts of law don't enjoy such privileges. New York shelters its lawyers from disciplinary measures more than most states in the country, even as it ranks near the top in total number of exonerations, a majority of which are the result of misconduct by prosecutors. Meanwhile, the few attempts to increase oversight of New York prosecutors have been stymied. A 2018 law established a commission specifically to deal with prosecutorial misconduct in a more independent and transparent way. But the State District Attorneys Association challenged it, and a court struck it down as unconstitutional. Lawmakers designed a new commission this year, but it appears that no commissioners have yet been appointed to it. New York's prosecutor protection racket is, alas, far from unique. In Washington, the U.S. Justice Department aggressively shields its own prosecutors from outside accountability thanks to a 1988 law that lets the agency essentially police itself. All other federal agencies and even parts of the U.S. Justice Department, like the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, are subject to oversight by independent inspectors general, who conduct thorough investigations and issue lengthy reports with their findings. Federal prosecutors skate by on an internal review process that is run out of the Office of Professional Responsibility, whose head is appointed by and reports directly to the Attorney General. The office almost never makes its findings public, and when it does, it often provides only a brief summary months after the fact. In the words of one legal ethics expert, it's a black hole. By contrast, the Inspector General's Office of the Justice Department just released its semi-annual report, as it is required to do by law, detailing the 52 reports it issued between April and September of this year, as well as the closing of investigations that resulted in 68 convictions or guilty pleas and 66 firings, resignations, or disciplinary actions. The level of scrutiny that federal prosecutors are subject to matters so much because they're just as prone to misconduct as their state and local counterparts. Take the botched prosecution of former Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska on corruption charges, or the legal green light Justice Department lawyers gave interrogators to torture terrorism suspects, or the more recent revelation that Jeffrey Epstein got a sweetheart deal in 2008 from his prosecutor Alex Acosta, who later became Labor Secretary in the Trump administration. Yet, in the latter two cases, the Office of Professional Responsibility found no misconduct. Alex Acosta was guilty only of poor judgment, the Office of Professional Responsibility said. In the Senator Ted Stevens case, The office found misconduct but said it was unintentional, and it let the prosecutors off with a slap on the wrist. Have there been other similarly egregious failures to hold prosecutors to account? Almost certainly, but we don't know because the US Justice Department doesn't tell us. There is no principled reason for federal prosecutors to avoid the accountability expected of all public servants. Their exemption from the general rule was adopted in 1988 as a favor to Dick Thornburgh, who was then the Attorney General and had tried to derail the creation of an Inspector General for the US Justice Department. Years later, Mr. Thornburgh admitted he had been wrong. This is a highly professional operation that goes where the evidence leads and is not directed by the way the political winds are blowing, he said at a gathering marking the law's 25th anniversary in 2014. I've come to be a true believer, he said. So have large numbers of Republicans and Democrats in Congress, a remarkable fact at the moment when the parties can't agree on the time of day. Their fix is straightforward. Eliminate the loophole in the 1988 law and empower the Inspector General to review claims against federal prosecutors, just as the office currently does in cases involving other Justice Department employees. A Senate bill co-sponsored by Mike Lee, Republican Senator of Utah, and Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, would do exactly this. Yet Attorney General Merrick Garland is continuing in the tradition of his predecessors by opposing any change to the existing system. Prosecutors can work in the interests of fairness and justice, but they can also cheat and destroy people's lives. They should be held accountable when they do that, both to vindicate their victims and to help ensure that they can't do it again.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, the people and the region as a whole. And as always, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives and make the alternative voices heard. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the upcoming so-called Summit for Democracy to be hosted by the US and why the list of invitees from South Asia raises more questions than answers. And we shall look at the recent spate of civilian killings and arbitrary detentions in Indian-controlled Kashmir that is fueling a new spell of unrest in the Himalayan region.
Soon after assuming office in January, US President Joe Biden announced his plan to hold a virtual summit for democracy to, quote, push back authoritarianism. With the list of the invitees out this week, critics are wondering whether it's the summit for democracy or hypocrisy. From South and Central Asia, the invitees include India, Pakistan, and Nepal, who share border with America's main rival, China. Pundits see it as a tactical move to woo these countries in order to counter China's growing influence in the region.
The much-hyped virtual Summit for Democracy, scheduled for December 9th to 10th, revolves around three key themes: defending against authoritarianism, addressing and fighting corruption and promoting respect for human rights, according to a U.S. State Department statement. But that's only one side of the story. The other side reveals America's global hegemonic ambitions and the desperation to contain China, which is clearly evident from the list of invitees, especially in the South Asia region. The summit brings together nascent democracies as well as authoritarian states, depending on the whims and fancies of policy wonks in Washington and America's strategic interests. India and Pakistan, the two regional stalwarts who exert considerable influence on the international stage, have both got invites. Nepal, too, has been invited, despite poor democracy record. Interestingly, all three countries share border with China, America's chief rival. Maldives, which has emerged as a key battleground for India-China rivalry, also figures on the list. Bangladesh and Sri Lanka have been snubbed, which points to possible direction of future U.S. policy in South Asia. For Bangladesh, it is an outright humiliation to be seen less democratic than many U.S. allies. Sri Lanka's omission is attributed to Prime Minister Rajapaksa's growing camaraderie with Beijing. Afghanistan's exclusion was expected, but who's responsible for the erosion of democracy there? The U.S. military-industrial complex.
The list of invitees for the so-called Democracy Summit, to be hosted by the chief saboteurs of democracy worldwide, is packed with snubs and surprises. While China and Russia are unsurprisingly omitted, India and Pakistan are both included. Invitations to the two South Asian strange neighbors has less to do with democracy and more to do with America's strategic interests and growing rivalry with China. While Indian Premier Narendra Modi is likely to attend the summit, Pakistan hasn't taken the call yet.
Invites to India and Pakistan for the so-called Democracy Summit did not come out of the blue, as Biden administration has stepped up efforts to woo the two countries following the botched U.S. exit from Afghanistan. It also has to be seen in the context of China's growing influence in the region. India has traditionally dismissed global concerns over issues of democracy and human rights, describing them as internal matter. In the last few years, New Delhi's brutal clampdown in Jammu and Kashmir region, anti-Muslim violence in New Delhi, and protests over controversial farm bills and the Citizenship Amendment Act drew global outcry. But in a view of rapidly changing geopolitical dynamics, US sees New Delhi as a key ally. On the other hand, Pakistan has been under the scanner over issues related to rule of law, terrorism, security of minorities, and endemic corruption. Imran Khan's government is beset with problems ranging from homegrown terrorism to shaky political-military alliance. But as Afghanistan's closest neighbor and China's all-weather ally, engaging with Islamabad has become a necessity for US. The invitation, though, has put Islamabad in a tight spot as it doesn't want to give arch-rival India a free hand at the summit. At the same time, it doesn't wish to antagonize Beijing. So, the jury is still out on it.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Jeremy Kuzmarov, the managing editor at COVID Action Magazine. He specializes in U.S. foreign policy and modern U.S. history. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Kuzmarov. Now, the list of invitees for the much-hyped Democracy Summit raises a lot of questions. The first one would be, is it designed to promote democracy or America's strategic interests?
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Russia and China issued, you know, an op-ed and statement criticizing the summit because, you know, they argue they reflect the kind of Cold War mentality and attempt by the United States, you know, to divide the world between good and bad, you know, democracy versus authoritarianism, you know, countries allied with China and Russia, and those, and Russia and China themselves are authoritarian, and the U.S. and its friends are, you know, beacons of democracy. And, you know, it's really a very simplistic view of the world. I mean, there's a lot of shades of gray. I mean, a lot of the countries allied with the U.S. have, you know, problematic democracies, if they are, democracies at all. Country like, the Congo and, India. I mean, there are many examples. Colombia and Latin America have a terrible human rights record. I mean, these are all countries invited to the Democracy Summit. And then, I mean, the United States itself, there are many problems within the United States, and people are seeing that the United States itself is not a model democracy. We've seen, the January 6th Capitol riots. We've seen, the growing role of money in politics, and many feel the U.S. has evolved more into an oligarchy than a democracy.
Now, many see the summit as a politically driven project that contains China, which is challenging America's global hegemony. What's your take on this?
Well, the invitation of Taiwan was very controversial, and that certainly has rankled the Chinese, and it kind of reinforces that this is very politicized, and that, the countries invited are, selected more for political reasons than them being model democracies. And I think, China has ground for criticism. And, you can also look, India is far from a model democracy. The Modi government has repressed the Muslim population within India. They received an invitation. A country like Nepal, largely, again, for political reasons. So I think, China's reason to be suspicious of this, and that the U.S. is just trying to build a block to counter China and trying to present themselves favorably before the world as this beacon of democracy, and to present China and Russia very negatively.
Mr. Kuzmarov, India is attending the summit, but there are reports about Pakistan consulting their close ally Beijing on its participation. Now, do you think it has put Islamabad in a tight spot?
Well, yeah, I think this is, much like in the Cold War, it's forcing countries, to choose side. Which side are they on? And it's, facilitating division between countries. And that's very dangerous. I mean, you can look back in history, the First World War started because of these alliances pitting, groups of countries against other groups of countries. So hopefully we won't have a repeat of the First World War, but, this is a dangerous direction that this could inevitably lead into a major world war.
And last but not least, what's your overall assessment of the summit? Now, do you think Americans have the moral authority to preach democracy, especially when their own democracy is in crisis?
Yeah, I think it's very self-serving. I mean, I think the United States wants to assert moral legitimacy as a world leader, and it wants to sustain the era of, unipolar U.S. world power. But I think we're living increasingly in a multipolar world order, and countries, like Russia and China are becoming more powerful, more influential, and alternative, economic blocs are developing to undercut U.S. power and influence in this more multipolar era. And, so the United States, I think, isn't fooling anybody anymore, because the world can see, the double standard of the United States when it comes to human rights and democracy, that many of their allies do have very poor records in this area or mixed records, and that the United States itself is very a flawed democracy with a bad human rights condition in its prisons. And we've seen some embarrassing U.S. leader like Donald Trump was an embarrassment for the United States, and the world was left wondering how somebody like him could get elected. And, the more people look into American politics, they see it as indeed more an oligarchy dominated by big money interests. So I think the rhetoric of the U.S. and this attempt to present themselves as this moral beacon is failing, and the world is moving more toward multipolarity.
Mr. Kuzmarov, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Fiona Edwards, an anti-war activist based in London, calls out America's terrible human rights record and says Biden's Democracy Summit is a hypocritical farce. Derek Grossman, Indo-Pacific analyst at RAND Corporation, asserts that the Biden administration blew up its Indo-Pacific strategy by inviting only 3 of 10 ASEAN members to the summit. Human rights activist Aya Mubaraku notes the absolute absurdity of the U.S. with collapsed democracy at home, calling for a global summit on democracy.
Indian-controlled Kashmir is again on the boil after a spate of killings in recent weeks. the Himalayan region has been rocked by protests, with people accusing Indian forces of murdering Kashmiri civilians in fake encounters and passing them off as militants. In two separate incidents, at least seven people were killed within a span of 2 weeks in the region's summer capital, Srinagar. Although authorities have ordered a magisterial inquiry into the killings, local Kashmiris see no hope for justice.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
On November 15th, four people were gunned down in an alleged encounter by Indian forces in Srinagar, Kashmir's summer capital. Police claimed the slain men were militants or associates, but families of the victims alleged that gunfight was staged and civilians were used as human shield.
Security forces took my father inside the building, not once but thrice. On the third turn, he did not return, and they say he was killed in crossfire. Now that they have killed my innocent father, they must return his dead body.
Authorities then refused to return the bodies, which sent ripples of outrage across the region, with both pro-India and pro-freedom groups taking to streets in protest.
Authorities say he was involved with fighter and killed in crossfire. We know he was an innocent. Now that he is dead, at least return his dead body. The police have denied us his last rites.
In another incident on November 24th, police killed three young men in Srinagar, dubbing them militants. Local witnesses, however, disputed the police version and said there was no exchange of fire and the slain men were innocent civilians. The incident further fueled anger and outrage across the region. Reacting to the two incidents, the region's former chief minister, Mehbooba Mufti, said official version of the incidents was far from truth and legitimate doubts loomed over the actions of Indian police. The pro-freedom conglomerate Hurriyat Conference unequivocally denounced the violence. Although authorities have ordered an inquiry into the first incident, families as well as local human rights groups believe such inquiries are eyewash to calm tempers. Hundreds of such magisterial inquiries have been conducted over the years into incidents of custodial killings, fake encounters, human shield incidents, rape and molestation, but reports have never seen light of the day.
Arbitrary detentions in Indian-controlled Kashmir have seen an alarming surge since the abrogation of the region's special status by right-wing BJP government in New Delhi 2 years ago. Many political figures, human rights activists and journalists have been detained under various draconian laws. On November 22nd, a prominent Kashmiri human rights defender, Khurram Parviz, was the latest to be detained by Indian authorities under an anti-terror law which drew widespread condemnation from global rights watchdogs. The arrest came days after the civilian killings which Parviz's organization had condemned.
One of the Kashmir's most eminent human rights activists, Khurram Parviz, is no stranger to police raids. It was a deja vu moment for him on the chilly afternoon of November 22nd when officials of India's Federal Counter-Terrorism Agency raided his home and office in Srinagar. He was arrested on charges of terrorism funding, criminal conspiracy, and waging war against the state under a much-abused counter-terrorism law frequently used against critics of the government. 44-year-old Parviz, program coordinator of the Jammu and Kashmir Coalition of Civil Society and president of the Asian Federation Against Involuntary Disappearances, has widely documented human rights abuses in the Himalayan region for more than two decades, which has often earned him the wrath of security agencies in India. In 2016, he spent over 2 months in jail after being prevented from flying to Geneva for UN Human Rights Council meet. In 2020, he was one of those targeted in counter-terrorism raids. Parviz's arrest comes amid growing crackdown on civil society groups and media in the contested region. Authorities are accused of using anti-terror laws against activists, journalists, protesters, and even social media users. In October 2020, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights raised an alarm over it and urged authorities to free people held for simply exercising basic human rights. The call fell on deaf ears.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mrs. Arthur Zia, Associate Professor of Anthropology and Gender Studies at the University of Northern Colorado. First of all, Mrs. Zia, welcome to the program. As we've seen, there has been a spate of killings in Indian-controlled Kashmir in recent weeks, with people accusing police of killing civilians and dubbing the slain as militants. So what's the truth?
Well, the truth is that there is a resistance movement in Kashmir, and this resistance is for right to self-determination, it's right to have free speech, have free all kinds of freedoms that usual people have. And for the government of India, all of these things are an anathema. They think everything that Kashmiris are doing is anti-sovereignty of India and all of that. And as a result, what's happening is that a condition has been created by this military occupation in which everything that the Kashmiris do, from the minimal level of breathing that they might do to showing their resistance in some form, whether that be armed or that be intellectual or that be, you know, doing activism for people's rights, that is the truth. The truth is it's a military occupation and that the government of India is cracking down on Kashmiris for seeking their freedom and their self-determination.
So a magisterial inquiry has been ordered by regional authorities into one of the incidents, but families call it an eyewash. So what has contributed to this lack of trust?
Well, one thing that the world needs to understand is that there's no lack of trust between India and Kashmir. There is no trust, so to speak. So let's begin with that. There is no trust deficit. Kashmiris don't want India. And after 2019, even India's own collaborators have understood how vicious and how tyrannical and how neocolonial India is. So the imperial heart of India has been seen by everyone. And I think the global the global community has also seen it. So whether it be a magisterial inquiry, which is the government's own people inquiring, or it be a judicial inquiry, both of them are pretty much the same, because both of them have created their own terrorism, their own brand of state terrorism for people, because they're props to the occupation. So it's not about trust. It's about occupation. It's about military occupation cracking down on people and creating these human rights violations, and then format of this government machinery coming forth and saying, let's have a probe, let's have a judicial probe. Kashmiris have seen hundreds of probes that have produced no results whatsoever. Hundreds of probes, and some by the local government and some by, you know, different bodies, but nothing has ever produced anything. And I think it's high time we take into cognizance and we do not use the word trust between Kashmiris and India. There is no trust, so to speak. It's an out-and-out Indian military occupation that has been there for the last 74 years, and that needs to be addressed. And we need to understand India's neocolonialism.
So why have the government crackdowns on activists, journalists, and protesters intensified in the contested region? What is the objective, in your opinion?
So the objective is repression of Kashmiri people. The objection is to make sure that the resistance movement is completely silenced, whether that be all types and formats of resistance movements. Kashmiri resistance movement is cultural, and they're making sure that they are trying to repress Kashmiris in all forms and manner. And for the last 72 years, 74 years, so to speak, from 1947 onwards, many laws have been passed that have essentially criminalized Kashmir's resistance movement. And what we see now is not something that's happening in this moment. This has been happening for the last 74 years. In the last 34 years, it has been increasing. And now we see the most repression that could happen that is kind of right now wreaked on Kashmiri people and Kashmiri society. And as part of that, journalists are the canaries in the coal mine. So what they did in 2020 was they passed a law, which is technically a law that is a media gag. So they created conditions that media cannot even properly report from the places where fights are taking place. They made sure that journalists are essentially also booked under these terror laws. They also made sure that the bureaucrats are the ones who are deciding what's fake news, what's incitement. So the journalists have slowly and slowly faced the censorship that had been already going on, and they had been working under extremely terrible conditions. But from 2020 onwards, everything is institutionalized. So now you have that kind of a condition created where no one can report what's happening inside. Whatever is trickling out is really minimal. And at the same time, you're cracking down on activists. So no one can actually report to the outside world what's happening inside, the basic human rights violations, the tyranny, the cruelty of this Indian military occupation that's happening. No one can really report in the manner that they need to. So now the conditions are perfect. You know, anyone who can report from outside, from inside Kashmir to the rest of the world, has to show government of India in a positive light, otherwise they will be thrown in the jail. So what we see, they created this condition, they institutionalized that nothing can go out reported without being vetted by the government, and as a result, the condition that has been created inside Kashmir at this present moment is one of extreme tyranny, that people are being killed in fake encounters. This is not new.
Thank you for your time, Mrs. Zia. Hope to have you back on the program again. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Senior Indian journalist Samar Harlankar, commenting on recent killings in Indian-controlled Kashmir, says one of the victims framed as a militant and tortured was a daily wager. UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights Defenders Mary Lawler says Khurram Parviz, a prominent Kashmiri human rights activist arrested recently, is not a terrorist. Anish Gawande, a student at Oxford University, reports about a massive protest held by students against extrajudicial killings and illegal detentions in Indian-controlled Kashmir.
And that was our episode on the hypocrisy of the host of the so-called Summit of Democracy and the deteriorating security situation in Indian-controlled Kashmir in the wake of the recent killings and arrests. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
A new report reveals U.S. military academies remain inundated by institutional racism despite minor gains since proclaiming anti-discrimination policies a decade ago to bring in more racially diverse students. Here we present you an article in this regard written jointly by Aaron Morrison, Helen Wiffering and Noreen Nasir, titled Report Says U.S. Military Academies Remain Plagued by Racism. Stay tuned for more. According to an AP report published on Friday, December 3rd, 8 years after he graduated from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, African-American Jeffrey Easterling remains astonished by the Confederate history still memorialized on the storied Academy's campus. The 6-foot-tall painting of Confederate Gen Robert E. Lee in the library, the barracks dormitory named for Lee, and the Lee Gate on Lee Road. He remembers feeling devastated as a black student at the Army Academy when a classmate pointed out that the slave also depicted in the Lee painting. He recalled thinking, as quoted in the report, how did the only black person who got on a wall in this entire human's school, how is it a slave? Easterling later traveled the country as a diversity admissions officer to recruit the students from underrepresented communities to West Point, and observed, it was so hard to tell people, like, yeah, you can trust the military, and then their kids Google and go, why is there a barracks named after Lee? According to the report, American military academies provide a key pipeline into the leadership of the armed services, and for the better part of the last decade, they have welcomed more racially diverse students each year. However, beyond blanket anti-discrimination policies, these federally funded institutions offer little details about how they screen for extremist or hateful behavior or address the racial slights that some graduates of color say they face daily. Earlier this year, AP published another report in which current and former enlistees and officers in nearly every branch of the armed services described a deep-rooted culture of racism and discrimination that stubbornly festers, despite repeated efforts to eradicate it. Less attention has been paid to the premier institutions that produce a significant portion of the services officer corps: the academies of the U.S. Army and the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Coast Guard, and U.S. Merchant Marine. According to the report, some graduates of color from top U.S. military schools who endured what they describe as a hostile environment are left questioning the military maxim that all service members wearing the same uniform are equal. That includes Carlton Shelley II, who was recruited to play football for West Point from his Sarasota, Florida high school and entered the academy in 2009. On the field, he described the term as a brotherhood where his skin color didn't matter. But off the field, he said he and other black classmates too often were treated like stereotype of the angry black man. Some students of color have spotlighted what they see as a systematic discrimination at the academies by creating Instagram accounts: Black at West Point, Black at USAFA, and Black at USNA, to relate their personal experiences. The latest annual defense spending bill mandated that the Defense Department survey all its military properties for references or symbols that potentially commemorate the Confederacy, including at West Point, which the commission overseeing the work picked as its first site to visit earlier this year. But the deadline to act on any recommendations is still more than 2 years away. Following the murder of George Floyd in 2020, which sparked global protest, a group of West Point alums released a 40-page letter urging the academy to address major failures in combating intolerance and racism, adding, "We hold fast to the hope that our alma mater will take the necessary steps to champion the values it espouses." Shelley said the academy has significant work to do to retain and support the students of color. He said in his class, he estimated about 35 black students graduated, some crazy low number, adding, "and we started with a lot of more." Citing 2019 data from the Under Secretary of Defense, the report notes, The academies are a growing pathway to officer status for black cadets, with about 13% of black active duty officers commissioned through the five institutions, compared to 19% of white active duty officers. Most students who enroll, nearly 60 to 70%, are nominated by U.S. senators or representatives from their home states as part of a system created in 1840s to build a geographically diverse officer corps. However, today the country's changed demographics mean the system gives disproportionate influence to rural congressional districts that tend to be whiter. According to a March report by the Connecticut Veterans Legal Center, only 6% of nominations to the Army, Air Force, and Naval Academies made by the current members of Congress went to black candidates, even though 15% of the population aged 18 to 24 is black. The report said 8% of congressional nominations went to Hispanic students, though they make up 22% of young adults. The diversity of nominations has improved slightly in the past 25 years, but the report noted that 49 Congress members did not nominate a single black student while in office and 31 nominated no Hispanic candidates. While the number of Hispanic cadets increased in the past two decades at the Coast Guard and Naval Academies, black cadets showed no noticeable increase during that time. In the class of 2000, there were 73 black midshipmen in Naval Academy and just 77 in 2020. At the Coast Guard Academy, there were 15 black cadets in the 2001 class, and in 2021, merely 16. Two of the five academies, West Point and the Air Force Academy, now have their first black leaders. But Sterling, the West Point graduate, noted that the faculty there remains mostly white, meaning students who don't see themselves and don't want to stay can find it hard to ask for help. Greg Elliott said he often found himself in trouble as a midshipman at the Merchant Marine Academy and was asked to leave without graduating. He doesn't blame the academy for his mistakes, and he said he never faced overt racism, but he wonders if a more diverse faculty and student body could have changed his course by making him feel he belonged. He remembers a fellow black alum telling him to just plow through with his head down and realize the academy was a terrible place to be at, but it's a great place to be from. Both Sterling and Shelley said they also saw signs of extremism during their time in the army. Timothy Berry, a former Army field artillery officer who graduated from West Point in 2013 and served as class president, said he never felt comfortable reporting racist incidents while at the academy, fearing it would draw unwanted scrutiny to him not being a perfect cadet, however minor his shortcomings might be. An Inspector General's report last year found the Coast Guard Academy had mishandled nearly a dozen race-based harassment charges between 2013 and 2018, and also noted that harassment was underreported in part because of concerns about negative consequences. Lieutenant Commander Kimberly Young McClear, a black woman who taught at the Academy from 2014 to 2019, said she herself faced years of harassment and retaliation on campus, which she had detailed in congressional testimony. Although the academies play a big role in the diversity of military leadership, some have argued that the pipeline begins even earlier, at the high school level. The Department of Defense sponsors junior ROTC programs at high schools around the country, where students can learn the values of the armed services, run drills, and wear the uniforms. According to a 2017 study sponsored by the Secretary of Defense, the programs are often located at high schools with larger than average populations of students of color. Though it may not be an official recruitment program, Junior ROTC promotes the military branches as a pathway to excellence. Cadets' handbooks for Navy, Army, Air Force, and Marine Corps all stipulate non-discrimination policies with regard to race and gender and emphasize treating everyone with dignity and respect. But former junior ROTC instructor Colonel Anthony Hopkins said little was done after one of his students at Lake Brantley High School in Florida alerted him to social media posts by her fellow cadets making racist comments about Hopkins, a retired black master sergeant. Economic divide.
In an unprecedented move, the U.S. has announced that it will release millions of barrels of oil from its reserves. But this move can backfire. Meanwhile, the U.S. President Joe Biden says there's enough petroleum to reduce the amount purchased from Iran. Hi, I'm Kavit Halfway. Stay tuned as we dive into the world of oil and the controversies surrounding it. Coming up, the U.S. tapping into its oil reserves to release 50 million barrels. So are a handful of other countries like China, India, and Japan. The reason? To tame inflation. But will it work? We will also take a look at OPEC, standing up to the U.S. and the rest of the world, rejecting the increase in production, saying that 400,000 barrels per day will suffice, an increase monthly. Is the U.S. and Saudi Arabia on a collision course over this matter? And finally, Iran's oil production, the world and the U.S. in particular, shooting itself in the foot. It can help with the oil shortage, this U.S. anti-Iran obsession affecting the rest of the world's economies.
The United States desperate to tame the price of oil. U.S. gasoline prices risen to a seven-year high. Average price $3.42 per gallon. Naturally, the U.S. looked to OPEC Plus to increase production. But it got the cold shoulder, especially from Saudi Arabia.
I think Japan, India, and the U.S. are seeking additional volumes. Am I correct? With regard to the U.S., yes, we've been having discussions at all levels.
OPEC would not open its taps as much as the U.S. and other big consumer nations wanted. A modest 400,000 barrels a day each month, their commitment.
So yes, we will keep the 400 on a monthly basis. We will review in December. We kept our window open for review.
The U.S. was now in panic mode, so it did what should be done in an emergency situation. The release of 50 million barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, SPR, to lower oil prices, to be done in parallel with other major energy-consuming nations, like China, India, the UK, Japan, and South Korea.
Now that the U.S. has decided to release 50 million barrels from its SPR, and there will be more coming from other countries, the question is, OPEC has basically planned to increase production by 400,000 barrels a day each month. They've been doing this for quite some time, and they plan to continue it into the new year. But this was seen as not nearly enough supply by the Biden administration, also by India and Japan. The question is, will OPEC react negatively to the SPR release and decide to curb its planned increases? And all the indications we're getting right now say no, that OPEC is planning to continue with its moderate increases in production.
position for the U.S. to be in. The U.S. president in particular is feeling the heat. It has low approval ratings on the one hand, and then you got inflation on the other hand, which could threaten the Democratic Party's chances for the 2022 midterms, and not to mention the whole presidency if things continue down this path for the U.S. Anyways, let's take a look at some social media posts in this segment. We're going to take a look at this particular one, which concerns the U.S. announcement that it will release 50 million barrels of oil from its reserves. It came from a reliable source, oilprice.com, which said President Biden's attempt to coordinate a crude release from major importers around the world has had a limited impact on oil prices and is likely to send prices even higher in the future. Notice two key unfavorable effects: limited oil impact, or limited impact on oil, I should say, and then for it to send prices higher. Okay, let's find out if we can get an answer to this from Sir Jiro Takeshita, professor of management and information at the University of Shizuoka. He specializes in comparative governance and international affairs. Well, Sir Jiro, welcome. Looking at this move by the handful of countries, which includes the U.S., for the release of oil from their reserves. The interesting thing about this is when the announcement was made, the price of oil actually increased as a result of this. Why did that happen, even though we're looking at the fact that oil is going to come into the market?
Well, actually, the market, especially the financial market, tend to basically move on expectation and not always the actual announcement that's been made. And when we had the announcement, it was in many cases much lower than many had anticipated, meaning that, you know, many people felt that the oil prices will remain high or even rise from there. Of course, that is before the new variant type of COVID-19 really, you know, became the big news.
Based on what our guest there said, let's take a look at some other tweets that perhaps can enlighten us more. Fresh off the Glasgow COP26 summit, this particular tweet actually fits in nicely to whether there's a real push for green energy. It said the Biden administration is not shutting down oil production and then tapping into our strategic oil reserves because they are stupid. It is intentional. The tweet said that they are manufacturing an oil crisis to push us to green energy. They don't care about you. In fact, they hate you. All right, hate is a strong word. But meanwhile, there is a solution that is staring the U.S. and the world right in their faces, particularly the U.S. President Joe Biden, and that is Iran. Biden officials have warned the Saudis for weeks that U.S. will act if OPEC doesn't, but the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, KSA, has stood up firm in refusing to increase output and has priced it wrongly in the view of the U.S. officials, the possibility that the U.S. reaches a nuclear deal with Iran and lifts sanctions on oil. Well, this is while the U.S. president made an outrageous claim just recently, which goes against the reality that is out there, that there's a shortage of oil and gas. He said that consistent with prior determinations, there is sufficient supply of petroleum and petroleum products from countries other than Iran to permit a significant reduction in the volume of petroleum and petroleum products purchased from Iran by or through foreign financial institutions. Okay, let's bring in Tom O'Sullivan. He is a director at Matthias, is an energy consulting firm who joins us here. Welcome, Tom. So when you take a look at how the world is suffering from an energy crunch, and in particular from a lack of oil production, which the prices of oil have shot up, and therefore you're looking at inflation, at least one of the reasons for inflation to have broken out, why is it then that the U.S. in particular and other countries are shooting themselves in the foot and not allowing oil to come into the market? Yes, I know U.S. sanctions are the reason.
Well, of course, you know, the discussions around the JCPOA are still going on, and I guess, you know, the Americans will be speaking to the Iranians, if I'm not mistaken, later this week. So I think on the sanctions and, you know, the Iranian situation, I think it very much depends on how the negotiations go over the next several days.
It's time now for our info news section of the program, economic news from around the world, which caught our attention from this past week. Food prices, they are about to soar. That's the grim assessment. The reason? A worldwide shortage of nitrogen fertilizer. Believe it or not, this time around, this is what's going to affect next year's food prices. Now, the global prices of nitrogen fertilizer are at their highest levels in over a decade. The crop nutrient sales amounted to $53 billion last year. Prices are at least 80% higher so far this year. That's according to Argus Media. So obviously, food prices are going to go up naturally as a result. On to electricity availability. That's the next topic of our next piece. It's more of an information piece of news, actually, more than anything else. I mean, did you know that 1 billion people lack access to electricity worldwide? The entry that caught our attention went on to say that solar power can help. It used Africa as an example, that many African countries simply lack transmission infrastructure to accommodate solar and wind installations. So somebody should get on the ball and make sure that the infrastructure to provide the access is done. Next up, U.S. wage inequality. Another example of it, this time at a franchise in the U.S. It's called the Dollar Tree. The store is dead. At this point, used to sell their items for a dollar. They can no longer do that. The Dollar Tree CEO, however, made $10 million last year and has blamed inflation for the price hike of the items to $1.25. Dollar Tree made over $1 billion in sales, giving its CEO over $10 million and paying workers as little as $8.32 an hour. All right, finally, Canada's children poverty is our final topic, where there was a grim assessment made of children's poverty in that country. More than 1.3 million Canadian children, or 17.7%, live in poverty. That's according to an annual report that was issued by the Campaign 2000. It said that is a pretty significant number of kids who are suffering from harm and effects of missing meals, not having the right kinds of clothes, and parents who are working really long hours.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to our in-depth section. It's worth taking a deep look at the fragile and dangerous predicament that the U.S. is in. After all, releasing emergency oil reserves is not something that can be taken lightly. First, there's the fact that the United States uses more gasoline than any other nation in the world. The figures are really astounding. Just in the year 2020, about 123.73 billion gallons, or about 2.95 billion barrels of finished motor gasoline were consumed in the U.S. That averages to about 338 million gallons per day, which translates to about 8.05 million barrels per day. Let me say that again, 8.05 million barrels per day. And that's on the downside due to coronavirus. So, why is the U.S. coming up short when it comes to gasoline? Why is there an increase in the price of gasoline? Well, when it comes to the price of gasoline, this is the story as of today, November 26th. You're looking at the average price that used to be $2.11, but now it's coming in at $3.40. That is an increase of 61% over 12 months. No wonder why Americans are alarmed. Well, did you ever think about how the gasoline that you pump into your cars is actually not pure gasoline? In other words, do you know what goes into the price of gasoline? Well, here it is, the price of crude, which amounts to more than half of the cost, roughly 50%. That price is largely determined by supply and demand worldwide. Then you're looking at things like ethanol and other additives, 10% and 5% respectively. And then things like distribution and marketing, which come in at around 18%. And then at the top there, you see taxes. In the U.S., it's roughly about 17% of the cost. The federal gasoline tax is actually 18 cents, while the average taxes and fees per state in the U.S. is 30 cents. What would the end of the year upon the United States, what is it looking at? Well, you're looking at travel holidays, 48.3.